Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Business IQ Radio Show, a non-commercial, non-political show coming to you on WBNH 105.1 out of Bedford, New Hampshire. I'm one of your hosts, Don Byrne, and with me, as usual, is my colleague, friend, and co-host, Andrea O'Brien of the New Hampshire Small Business Development Center. Hello, Andrea.
Hello, Don. Great to be back.
So this is going to be an interesting show. We have a fascinating guest in the latter part, John Clayton, who is the executive director for the Manchester Historic Association, and he also runs the Mill Yard Museum in Manchester. And I think he's well known to a lot of our listeners because he was on TV for about 6 years in the New Hampshire Chronicle TV show and has written for the Union Leader for a very long time. So I'm looking forward to having John in the studio with us. I'm sure he's going to have some interesting stories to tell us.
And who doesn't love a good history lesson?
Exactly. And it's going to focus on the development of business here in Bedford and in Manchester. I need to clarify with him. I think I had the opportunity to take a tour of the museum with John. I was hoping to be able to get into the underground tunnels, but we weren't able to do that. We'll have to ask him about that. He denied that they exist, but I wonder still if they're there or not. And I was really impressed with the message of diversity and the message of how Bedford and Manchester have really thrived and survived by constantly reinventing themselves. And I think that'll be a very interesting part of the show to talk about.
You know, it's so important to be able to access these great resources that Manchester has, like the museum. And I believe that they're having an event on June 4th. Do you know?
I think it's a walking tour, something like that. I think there's a walking tour, a river walk tour. We'll have to ask John about that and get some clarification on that. So,
well, you know what they say about succeeding? Without knowing 1,000 years of history, you're destined to live hand to mouth.
That's right.
And even though we're not covering 1,000 years, I think reflecting on the last 100 or so years help us.
But I think, as I remember, so I'm smiling as you say that, because when you go to the museum, one of the first things you see is an exhibit of pottery that I think they've dated back about 11,000 years that they found in the river. So we actually, wow, it does go pretty far back. The other thing I'd like to do as we launch the show today is tell you listeners how happy Andrew and I are to see that some people have been contacting us and asking about if we're on Facebook, if we're on Twitter, if we have a website, and how to get in contact with us. So here's a quick update. We do have a Twitter feed. You can reach us at TBIQS, which stands for The Business IQ Show. So TBIQS on Twitter. We don't yet have a Facebook account. It's in the works, in the process. We're working on it. And we have commissioned a website to be developed, and that'll be coming to us probably mid to late June. If you want to email us, the best way to do that is to use a Gmail account we have set up until our website goes live. And the email address is BIZIQshow, so BIZIQshow, BIZIQshow at gmail.com. So BIZIQshow at gmail.com will get to us. We're very interested in any suggestions you have for show topics, for guests, features that you'd like to see. And we are thinking about adding a few new features once we have the website up and running, but we'll hold that under the covers for a little bit and tell you more about that as we get closer to it. But Andrew and I are putting our heads together and thinking a lot about these issues. So now, before we get to our guest for today, John Clayton of the Manchester Historic Association, I think we should start off, as we normally do, with our Business IQ Radio Show Roundup. And Andrew, if you don't mind, I'll kick this off. I have a few things to bring up. First is that I was, some of these come from New Hampshire Business Review, by the way. I was interested to see that the New Hampshire Community Development Finance Authority has awarded $2.76 million in community development block funds that are going to be used to support about six different communities throughout the state. So we're seeing some investment coming in that, investing in that infrastructure and affordable housing and things like that are very important for us to see our businesses thrive. It's not directly related to everybody here in Bedford, but it certainly begins giving us access to the workforce that hopefully we'll be using to employ people in and around the area.
So you mentioned Community Development Loan Fund. They have money available for energy improvements.
Oh, okay.
And it's easy to access. You know, give them a call. And I think anybody using, you know, a sizable amount should definitely check them out.
Yeah, we've discussed in the past maybe having somebody from Eversource come in and talk to us about some of the initiatives and programs they have as well. So we have to put that and work that into the calendar. Another sort of interesting tidbit that I saw was there are a series of workshops that are starting up that are targeted at real estate professionals. And these workshops are designed to help them learn the do's and don'ts of buying and selling land, which have protected land easements attached to them. So for more information on that, you can check out with the New Hampshire University Cooperative Extension. Speaking of schools, and we all know the key role that education plays in the state, I noted with interest the Riviera University down in Nashua is about to launch a doctorate in nursing practice. And they made the comment when they announced that they were going to be offering this PhD program that there is a real shortfall of top executive leaders in the healthcare industry in our area, and they're looking to help fill that gap. So if you're in the nursing profession, you have an interest in the nursing profession, good to know that the local university systems are spending some time and effort on that. And the last tidbit I have, and then I'll turn it over to you, Andrew, see if you have any, is that it seems that the State Executive Council is still arguing a little bit about whether or not we should have a commuter rail spur come into New Hampshire. This is a topic that interests me, especially since I learned that Bedford used to have a railroad station in town. Apparently, there was a Milford to Manchester rail line operating in the late 1800s. I think it was charted and approved of in 1893, but construction was delayed. I know it ran for only about 26 years, but what I found interesting is that one of the ways that they're memorializing this and bringing it back into everyone's attention is that the geocaching people have placed a geocache at the site of the old Bedford Railroad Station where the train used to stop. And so if you're someone who's into geocaching, you can get some sense of where it is, go search it out. That's actually a lot of fun. I know that, Andrew, you're an outdoorsy person. You love camping. And I know that I'm not sure if geocaching is something you do or do not do a lot. Apparently, it's near Nashua Road and looks out on what today is Route 101. And again, I think that the aspect of transportation and supply chain is so critical to us that we really, we might want to consider doing a show on that. So to the listeners, and you're listening to the Business IQ show here on 105.1 WBNH with Don Byrne and Andrea O'Brien, if this is a topic that's of interest to you, please do contact us either through Twitter or through the email account we gave before, which is the bizibiqshow@gmail.com. So those are my tidbits for the week, Andrea. I wonder if you have any tidbits or something that you'd like to jump in with.
Well, you know, I do love camping, but I have never done geocaching. How about you? Have you ever tried it?
I have, yeah. We ran into it. I was out west. It was in, I think it was, where were we? We're probably in North Dakota, and we were doing some hiking, and we stumbled upon a geocache. We wondered what it was, and we opened it up, and we found out what it was, and then we looked into it, and we did some research. A lot of fun. It's an interesting
Is it a stamp or is it a...
Oh, this happened to be an old ammo box. And what you do is there are a number of items that are kept in it and a record. And so the guideline is that you, if you take something, you put something in, you record that you found the geocache, you put down who you are and where you come from. And you're supposed to use disposable cameras in there, take a photograph of yourself and add to it. And then they collect these and you can, there are people who go around the country looking at these different geocaches. And it's like if people are out walking the Appalachian Trail, they have as a goal or some other thing. So it's fun. I think there are about 26 geocaches in and around this particular area. I know there are a few up in Manchester as well.
Wow. I'm going to have to look into that.
So, anything that you have for this week?
Well, actually, over the weekend, I did something very exciting. It was we went to Malden, Mass, and participated in this new adventure business, and the name of the company is called Bodaborg. It was my niece's birthday, and it was amazing. It was about questing. Have you heard of questing?
Well, I know of questing as an online game, a multiplayer game. It's only in that context that I know anything about it.
Well, this is not online. It's real. And it was the most fun I think I've ever had. I was there for hours and hours. But that brings me to two Manchester-based businesses and that are similar but with a twist. They're called Room Escapes or Escape Rooms, and two are now open and operating in Manchester. And actually, this is just a new trend in entertainment. The two companies are called Locked and also Granite State Escape.
Mm-hmm.
So you get locked into a room and you have to discover the clues. You work as a team. I think these rooms take, more than 10 people, maybe 10 to 20 people, some of them. And it could keep you busy for a few hours. So it's a great opportunity to put your heads together with some friends. And so I wanted to bring that to everyone's attention that this is new trend and some new business up there in Manchester.
Is there any way to find out more about this? Should they just go to one of the search engines or... Did you read about it in any particular place or something like that?
It was in the latest edition of Business New Hampshire magazine.
Okay, and what would be the date on that? Since we do replays of the show for people to go back and look at this.
May of 2016.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Well, with that, why don't we begin to get ready for our next guest? Again, you're listening to Business IQ Radio on 105.1. WBNH with Don Byrne and Andrea O'Brien. And let's bring in our guest, John Clayton, of both the Mill Yard Museum and the Manchester Historic Association. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Don. Well done on that name.
Well, thank you very much. I can tell our listeners, if they haven't visited your museum, they really should. I was quite impressed by the quality and the variety of exhibits that I saw. Perhaps that's a good place to start a discussion. Can you tell us a little bit about the museum, what people might expect to see when they visit the site?
Certainly. By way of starters, the Manchester Historic Association was founded in 1896 by Frank Carpenter, which is a name that should be familiar to a lot of your listeners who remember the Carpenter Hotel in Manchester, Camp Carpenter, the Boy Scout camp. So the Carpenter Memorial Library for another. So Frank Carpenter had this vision in 1896 of an institution that would collect, preserve, and share Manchester's history. And for the better part of a century, the organization did that. And in 2000, the year 2000, they opened the Mill Yard Museum. We had found that the collection had grown so dramatically that 90% of it was in storage and only 10% was visible to the general public. So opening space at 200 Bedford Street in the Mill Yard Museum gave us 15,000 square feet in which we can now display basically 11,000 years of history on the area that we now know today as Manchester.
Yeah, and Andrea, this is right across the street from your office. It's diagonally across from your office there at UNH.
Yes, we've been there. Actually, they hold several fundraisers there, groups mm-hmm. like it's very, very conducive to mingling and yeah. really a rich, rich environment to gather.
Yeah, well, mentioned
we have great rental space, and so we do hold a lot of events. And there's something you're right about the atmosphere. It's very conducive to having a very positive fundraiser or, you know, corporate event.
When I told Andrea that I was going over there with my wife, Melindy, she said the same thing Melindy did, which is, I wonder if we can get into the tunnels. So at some point in time, maybe we can ask you to tell us about what the tunnels are and the tunnels. And I think they were, as I learned from you, they were initially used to power the looms in the woolen mills.
Right. They're known as penstocks. And that's a bit of folklore that keeps growing and growing. I keep getting asked about it more and more. So, yeah, we can set the truth out for everybody who wants to know more about that.
Well, good. Before we get into that, though, as you can imagine, we like to learn a little bit about our guests. You have a real wide variety of background. You've written a number of books. You've been on television here in New Hampshire. Yes. You've been involved with the newspaper. Can we ask, how about giving us a little resume? Tell us a little bit about your background and maybe leading up to how you got involved with the museum and the Historic Association.
The Reader's Digest version. I can
yeah,
do that.
Please.
Well, a lot of your listeners, I believe my name would not be unfamiliar to them because I spent 27 years at the New Hampshire Union Leader, 17 of them as a columnist writing about Manchester and then a second column per week about New Hampshire. So my exposure on the front page was pretty good, which, as you indicated, led to a brief career in television. I'd never envisioned hosting a magazine program called New Hampshire Crossroads on New Hampshire Public Television. So that media presence is probably how many of your listeners might be familiar with me.
I wouldn't call 6 years a brief bit of time there.
Well, two Emmy Awards, too, which I tell my friend Charlie Sherman about all the time. He's happy when I do that. Sorry, Andrew.
And unlike Don and I, you actually do have a face for TV. Don and I have a face for radio.
We're on radio now. So
yeah, we always say a face for radio and a voice for print.
Right, so. That's me all over as well. But I'm a local boy. I was born and raised on the west side of Manchester, attended public schools, including West High School at a time when Bedford students were still attending West. Yeah. My college roommate was a Bedford kid who I never would have met if it weren't for the two towns or city and town coming together. So I have very nostalgic memories about my Bedford friends from high school. From that, went on to Northeastern University, got a degree in journalism because I always wanted to be a writer. Graduate degree from Boston University in communications. I was a Rotary Foundation fellow, spent a year in Cardiff, Wales on a journalism fellowship, one of 50 in the world. And they realized there was an American on campus in Wales, so they came looking for me during registration and orientation and asked if I played basketball. And I said, yeah, I do. And they said, well, you'll be on the team. Can you dribble with your left hand? And I said, yes. And they said, you'll start. So in fact, that year I spent in Wales, I was the starting point guard for the University of Wales basketball team. At that time, I was working at what is now Southern New Hampshire University as the public relations director and sports information director. And it was in that capacity that the Union Leader reached out. And Joe McQuaid, the publisher, said, how come you're not working for me? And I said, nobody asked me. And he said, consider yourself asked. So from that, my newspaper career was launched, and that begat the seven books and begat the Crossroads, and really allowed me to celebrate the city and state that I love so much in print and on television.
So here's the hard question. Did you learn to speak any Welsh or at least pronounce some of those crazy towns with sort of 30 letters that many of which are consonants without vowels between
it
them?
It is an amazing dialect. And by way of comparison, to give people a sense of what it's about, you know, the U.S. military in World War II used the Navajo tribe as what they call wind talkers because the Navajo language is so impenetrable that they knew that the codes could not be broken as long as they protected the lives of the Navajo. Well, in Great Britain, they use Welsh speakers as their wind talkers because the Welsh language, if you're not native born, is absolutely unintelligible. So that's the parallel. If you're wondering why Don asked the question, did I learn to speak Welsh? The short answer is no. If I answered in Welsh, it would be 37 letters to say no.
Before we get into a little bit of the history of business in and around Bedford and in and around Manchester, just to complete the discussion of the museum, where do your exhibits come from? And I ask that because I suspect that you're always interested if people have interesting bits of memorabilia to at least submit them for your consideration for the museum. I'm particularly interested in some of the archival options you have as well. So there's actually research can be done, as I recall.
Yeah, we have two areas of expertise. One is on 129 Amherst Street in downtown Manchester on the so-called Cultural District, which is the Historic Association that opened in 1936. People may remember that. But when the Milliard Museum came, we had two footprints. One is that research library now, which is where all the genealogical work is done at 129 Amherst, and the museum display is at 200 Bedford Street. So we have two very distinct presences in the community. And that is where the archival material is stored. Incredible glass plate negatives from the Amesquick Manufacturing Corporation throughout the company's existence. I have labor records from Amesquick. So if you have relatives, for example, who worked at Amesquick, you can come to our museum and you can actually view their individual labor records. I've gone through those of my grandparents and my aunts and my uncles who worked at Amesquick. So it's a great treasure that is probably underutilized, and we'd love to see more people use it.
Terrific. Again, just to remind everybody, you're listening to the Business IQ radio show with Don Byrne and Andrea O'Brien, and our special guest today, John Clayton of the Manchester Historic Association and the Milliard Museum. I remember when I visited you, John, I think I got this right, that at one time Manchester was actually part of Bedford, or am I misstating or overstating the case?
No, West Manchester in particular. The Merrimack was the great divider at all times. And before Amesquick Manufacturing came into play in 1831 is when they were founded. And the city was planned from that point forward. Prior to that, West Manchester and Bedford were almost inseparable. The Goths, the Starks, people who lived on the west side of the river. It was almost a contiguous community alongside the river. So people who remember Squog, the neighborhood where the Piscataquag River runs through Manchester, Bedford and Squog Village were very much part of a whole at the time.
You know, the rivers have a significant role to play in manufacturing in the city of Manchester. Is there a lot of information on the environmental impact that the mills have had on these rivers?
I'll preface before you answer, John, but that Andrea's role at the Small Business Development Center at UNH is as the sustainability environmental person for the state. So that's why there's a very, she always has an ongoing question around the question of environmental impact.
It's actually, there's a three-part answer, and it's a great question, because in the earliest days of Amesquick, when Samuel Blodgett built his first canal for commerce, the people who came in and created Amesquick wanted to use the canals for power for mills. Originally, they were just small grist mills that were there, and then they wanted to go into manufacturing. So they built two canals that ran parallel to the Merrimack River. One is what is now Bedford Street. The canals have been filled in. And there was a canal at Commercial Street as well. Those canals would flow through, and in every mill, the pipes you're talking about, Don, are actually called penstocks. Mm. And these were water channels that would actually, the water would run through the canals, enter the building, come in through the pipe, hit a turbine, turn the turbine, which in turn would power all the looms in the building. And if you think about the east side of the mill yard, it flows downward toward the river. So the natural gravitational pull of the water would be to go back toward the river. So in fact, it would go through my building, at the mill number 3, power the looms, go through a discharge penstock into the second lower canal, and then it would go into the buildings along the canal, and then it would simply discharge right back into the river. So in the beginning, there was negligible impact on the environment because all the water that went into the canals went back into the river and made its merry way down the Lowell and Lawrence and eventually down to Newburyport, Mass., going back into the Atlantic Ocean. In a secondary phase, when Amesquick went from water power to steam power, they also took on new products. In the beginning, they made a cotton fabric called ticking, which is what you might know, the blue stripe material that goes over mattresses. Eventually, they made denim, which Amesquick denim was used to make the first Levi's ever made. It was shipped out to San Francisco and fashioned into jeans out there.
Wow.
But in that process, they also started doing gingham dresses, and that involved dyeing. Blue denim does not occur naturally in nature. The cut fabric had to be dyed. So in that stages of Amesquick's development, you could tell by looking at the river what particular fabrics and colors were being used in the dyeing process. So Amesquick started having a very deleterious effect on the Merrimack River. Pollution got even worse as you got into the 60s when the canals were closed. Essentially, they were like open sewers because they weren't rushing water through. So in that period in the 50s and 60s, Amesquick, or the Merrimack River, was in terrible, terrible shape. We had a slaughterhouse where Elliott at River's Edge is now, and on the given day, you could look out in the discharge vents, you'd see nothing but blood running into the river, intact cow hides. This is my childhood. I played a game at the Bakersville School, which is just across the Queen City Bridge, and had to play the entire baseball game with my glove over my face because the stench from the slaughterhouse was so overpowering. But then came the Fresh Water Act, the Clean Water Act. So beginning in 1967, it was incumbent upon Manchester to clean up the Merrimack River, and the strides they've made in the 30, 40, 50 years since are unbelievable. If you were of my age and remember when the river had refrigerators and cars and bicycles and shopping carts, when low water would be visible, those items would be visible too. So the city's come an enormous, enormous way from the bad, bad days of the height of the exploitation of the Merrimack River.
That's so interesting.
Well, you weren't playing baseball at Bakersfield with your glove over your face. It was more than interesting.
Right. So you mentioned one of the prominent people who helped really build and develop the business in this area. And I think it was primarily the canals that led to the development of the woolen business. Can you tell us a little bit about the company that did that? And I think when I took a tour, you had some very interesting comments to make about the migration of different populations sure. from Canada and elsewhere and who we attracted. And even in those days, we were sort of a diverse community in this area, right?
Very much so, because of Amiskig Manufacturing. It was Samuel Blodgett who had the vision to build that canal for his lumber business to move logs up and down the river without having the trouble at the Amiskig Falls. So that was his idea. He went to the legislature and thought it would be great for the state to have this process take place, and he asked for financing, but this is New Hampshire. So they said, we love the idea, but you're on your own. We're not going to give you any money. So Samuel Blodgett had a lottery in which he raised the money that allowed him to build the canals, which is a very typical way of raising money in New Hampshire to this day. Blodgett wanted Manchester to become an industrial city on the same scale as Manchester in England, and he expressed that. So in 1810, Manchester at that time was known as Derryfield. The city fathers agreed to honor his vision, and in that sense, they named the city Manchester. That's where the name came from our sister city in England. So Blodgett's vision came to pass, and then Amiskig decides they want to make it an industrial vision more than a commercial vision. And to that extent, they hired a gentleman named Ezekiel Straub, a 19-year-old engineer. Amiskig, the company, which was Boston-based but Manchester-centered, purchased 15,000 acres of land along the Merrimack River. They set aside 700 acres for industrial zoning right on the river, and then the rest was to be developed as a community in which people who worked in the mills could have a place to live and play and worship and go to school. And so Ezekiel Straub made Manchester the first planned urban community in America. And his template was a beautiful one. It was orderly. The parks were well-spaced. The schools were spaced. The churches were. And the trees, streets were named after trees rather than the harsh grid of Manhattan with West 26th and East 5th. He had linden, ash, maple, beech, pine, chestnut. And it's a place people wanted to live. And so by doing that, Manchester had become very prosperous to the point that they quickly outstripped the local labor force. They were so successful, they needed more workers. The easiest and first solution was to go to the Canadian Maritime Provinces, Quebec and the Maritimes, because at this time, 1840, 1850, a lot of the family farms in eastern Canada were failing. So Amiskig would put agents on the train because it was an easy passage up to Montreal and to Quebec, and they would recruit entire families to come back and work in the mills. So Manchester suddenly had a French-Canadian component to it. Most of the laborers who built the mills, dug the canals, dug the foundations, laid the granite and the brick, were Irish who were coming to escape the Great Famine. So right away, you start with Scots-Irish native population here. You've added Irish and French-Canadian to the mix. As Amiskig grew, its product line grew, so they needed to get different people with expertise in different techniques of cloth and fabric making. The Scots were the greatest dyers in the world. That's where gingham originated, so Amiskig put people on boats now, and they went to Scotland, and they brought back Andrew Mungall, who had all kinds of Scottish friends who came and joined him at Amiskig to do the dyeing. The Germans were great engineers. Amiskig had the foundry in which they made all of the hardware they needed in the mill yard, right intact, very self-contained and very self-supportive. So German engineers came to Manchester to work in the foundry as engineers. So it was an amazing expansion that involved ethnic integration, not racial integration, but ethnic integration. So Manchester, in also getting Polish and Greek workers and Belgians who came and made lace. They were great. Swedes were great lace makers. So because of Amiskig's manufacturing needs, Manchester suddenly became this incredibly diverse community, which is often lost to history because, you know, when the primary rolls around, we're always, you know, described as a lily white state of New Hampshire, when in fact, we have an incredible ethnic diversity here and have since 1850, which we're now celebrating at the Mill Yard Museum.
And that diversity continues today. I think a year or two ago, New Hampshire had the highest percent change in immigration.
Mm-hmm.
in the country.
And to celebrate that, Andrea, what we're doing now is we have an exhibit called Manchester's Immigrants Then and Now, and we've spelled it out that way on purpose. There's a young woman who's just done a book called Different Roots, Common Dreams. Her name is Becky Field. It was her project for her commencement or her bachelor's degree at the New Hampshire Institute of Art. And so she had incredible access to the new Americans, the current immigrant and refugee community. So I knew Becky well, and I asked her if she would go together with us in an exhibit that would allow us to juxtapose her new and contemporary images, which are wildly colorful and striking, with our historic photos of those early immigrants coming to Manchester. Again, the Irish, French, Canadian, the Belgians, and Germans. And so this exhibit we have in place now at the Milliard Museum has been very powerful because we are going out of our way to bring in all the school groups to let them see Manchester has been doing this for 150 years. We are really good at assimilating people and making them part of the fabric of the community. And it's very telling. I know, Don, you've seen the exhibit. And at the end, we put a world map on the wall. And we put blue pins to recognize all the countries that were represented in the photographs on the wall. Now, when visitors come, we ask them to take a red pin and put it in the country where their family resided before they came to Manchester. And we've already gone over 50 different nations of people who've come to see this exhibit, a lot of them kids. It's so touching. We had a big group from the Bhutan come in last week. And rather than everybody wanting to put one pin in, they agreed that they would put one pin into the map at Bhutan to represent all of them. And this morning, we finally had a gentleman from Australia. Don commented on the absence of a pin in Australia. Well, we solved that dilemma today. So it's a very touching moment for them, because if they look at their nation of origin and there's no pin there, they're so excited because they can be the first one to put it there. And conversely, when they look at their nation, they're, if they see pins, they're thrilled to know that others from their land have come here. And think to that point where you may feel like a stranger in a strange land, but this community does a great job of helping people assimilate and become part of it. So I tell the kids, 20 years from now, one of you may be standing in my place talking about the history of Manchester and how your family has become a part of that history.
So we're talking to John Clayton of the Manchester Historic Association about the history of the development of business in and around Bedford and Manchester. And I appreciate the background. Maybe this explains why when I go to St. Mary's Bank, I actually have the option of having an ATM that's either in English or French.
Very, very astute observation. That is the genius of a parish priest at St. Mary's Church named Monsignor Pierre Heavey. Back when the French Canadians started working in the mills, payday, you literally received a pay packet with cash. And the French-speaking Canadian workers were very leery of entrusting their money to the English-speaking bankers who populated Elm Street. So what would they do? They would literally take their pay packet home to their tenement building on the west side. And what would they do? They would literally put it under the mattress. You've heard this and to the point of becoming folklore. Well, that happened. And after there were a series of tenement fires, these were wood-framed three-story buildings, Monsignor Heavey saw several of his parish members completely wiped out financially because everything they had literally went up in smoke. And so he heard of a movement in Montreal in which they were embracing this new movement called the credit union. And so he went to Montreal and he brought a couple of the proponents back with him to St. Marie's. And they actually sat down, made the presentation in the church at that day. All the parishioners signed up agreeing that they would become a part of this new credit union. And that's how St. Mary's Bank became the first credit union in America. In 1908, and in 2008, when they celebrated their centennial, I got to be the spokesman as a third-generation member of St. Mary's Bank. So there was a credit union museum at the corner of Notre Dame and Amory Street in Manchester, and they're about to spend $3.5 million to make it a national research center for credit unions around the nation. So my museum is going to have to do some work to keep up with their museum because they're investing a lot of money and a lot of personal and political capital to get that done.
I think Manchester has staked its claim of being the credit union
capital of America.
Right. Yeah. So we're going to stake its claim. Can I ask you about workforce and workforce development over the decades or centuries? I'm from Amherst, and we had a great presentation about the mill girls. Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about the workforce in the mills or in the early 1800s, is
sure. Yeah, in the early 1800s. Well, the earliest incarnation for the looms, it was a woman's duty. It wasn't a man's duty to make cloth. So the earliest employees of Emmaskeg were very much dominated by women. That's why we have the statue of the mill girl in the mill yard, which you probably can see from your office. She's representative of generations of young women who came to work in the mills. And part of that was because Emmaskeg was very benevolent in the way in which they cared for their employees. Young women who came here from their farms in Quebec, let's say the family didn't come with them, Emmaskeg promised that they would give them clean housing, educational opportunities, places to worship and study and play. And Emmaskeg was very true to that. So there were never real shortages of women who would work in the mills. Yes, did children work in the mills? We're often asked that question. The great photographer Lewis Hine came to Manchester for one day as he was traveling around the country chronicling child labor. And it was true that children as young as 9 years old were being employed by Emmaskeg. The company tried to waffle and fudge it a little bit, but it was pretty obvious that that was happening. And many of them were girls, because if you look at the technology of the looms in the day, if you've ever seen the movie Schindler's List, Oscar Schindler talked about the fact that the children's hands were small so they could go in and polish the brass and shells. Same argument was made by Emmaskeg in terms of the looms, that kids had small hands so they could get in there and they could actually make that work. So that was part of it too. But again, a large percentage of Amiskeg's workforce were women. And that was just the law of the land as it unfolded in a very organic way.
And it wasn't really necessarily a bad thing. I mean, these women lived well and made a good wage for their families.
Mm-hmm. They did. They made a good wage. And when it was an entire family coming in, the family prospered, as did the company. So it was very beneficial. And that's why many people, from a business point of view, always viewed Manchester as a strikeless city. There was not going to be the labor unrest in Manchester that occurred in nearby in Lowell and Lawrence, for example, because we had, this sounds pejorative, but we had what they called a docile labor force, because a Catholic, worshiping French-Canadian family is not going to go on strike when it means every single member of the family will be out of work. The family simply can't persist in that way. So they thought, Emmaskeg knew they had a lot of latitude. Again, they remained benevolent when times were good, but at some point, times were not so good. After World War I, 1918, when Emmaskeg had benefited from a lot of military contracts, making stockings and uniforms for soldiers, that was the end of the boom times. So by 1922, production was so slow that Emmaskeg issued an edict. The work week would go from 48 to 54 hours per week, while the pay rates were dropped by 20%. That was the straw that broke the camel's back for the strikeless city. We were represented by the United Textile Workers. And when I say we, I mean the Emmaskeg employees. Lowell and Lawrence had the International Workers of the World, the Wobblies, a very red, Bolshevik, violent union that really had troubles with violence down in those towns. We did not. But in 1922, Emmaskeg shut down. The strike closed them down for 9 months. And in that time, imagine all these families, everybody was on relief, everybody was on the dole, as they say in Wales, and it was very, very difficult time. The production was lost, estimated at $50 million in 1922 dollars, and after that prolonged, bitter 1922 strike, they simply went back to work and accepted the terms. More than money was lost, however, it was the sense of trust that the workers had in Emmaskeg, because they truly believed in the company, and there was a family spirit that never returned after that. So again, much more than money was lost in that strike.
We're talking to John Clayton here on the Business IQ radio show on 105.1 WBNH. And John, we've come through to 1910, but I want to step back a little bit. I wonder, did the Civil War have an impact on the manufacturing? Because if it was primarily textile, and we know that there had to be some cutback in terms of access to product, was there an impact on the economy here? How did the Civil War affect this textile business, I guess, is what I'm asking.
It's a great question, Don. And it did have an effect. I mean, to their credit, the people at Emmaskeg saw the problem coming. They would send their trains down to the south and they would have the cotton picked. Raw cotton would go on the train and come back up north, make a 1,000-mile journey to come to Manchester. And they had a sense that that line would be cut by the Civil War that they saw coming. So they stockpiled almost more than 3 million pounds of raw cotton in anticipation of that boycott, if you will. And so when the war started, their prescience paid off. They were able to keep manufacturing cloth. And as the war wound on, they went through that supply. A couple of mills were closed. And coincidentally, the gentleman I mentioned named Ezekiel Straw had a friend named Abraham Lincoln. who was introduced in Manchester in 1860 before he was elected as the next president of the United States. So Abe Lincoln always had a nice warm feeling for Manchester and Amesquite because he toured the mills when he was here. His son was a student at Phillips Exeter Academy, which is what brought him here. So he called Ezekiel Straw and said, I understand you have some mills that are closed now because you can't get the cotton. Can you possibly retool the mills and make something for the Union Army effort, that in the form of Springfield rifles for the Union Army? So Amesquite's engineers were dispatched to Springfield, Massachusetts to exactly replicate the process by which they manufactured the Springfield rifles there. And so Manchester actually had two mills that were devoted to making arms for the Union Army. And the catch-all that people seem to enjoy is if you worked at Amesquite making rifles for the Union Army, you were exempt from the Union draft. So there was no shortage of people who wanted to work at Amesquite making rifles as a way to stay out of the Civil War.
Well, and it's interesting in the context of even business today, they reinvented themselves. They took whatever assets they had and they found a new way to reinvent themselves. And that certainly continues in terms of business trends today. Organizations are having to find a way of newly creating. And I think the statistic, there are a number of books out about really the most successful companies reinvent themselves in some way about once every 7 years. So, even
the mill yard has reinvented itself. Again, going from a very intense labor, production company to the high-tech giant that it is now. It's an engine that drives the economy throughout New Hampshire, and it's that reinvention that you're talking about. And Amesquite was a genius at reinvention. When they found that they were doing all they couldn't by way of making fabric, the foundry, which was so successful in producing hardware for the company, someone said, why don't we use that? Let's start making steam locomotives. So in the Manchester Mill Yard, they made as many as 60 steam locomotives a year. And think about the mammoth nature of that project versus making, small cogs and wheels that would help power a simple loom. To, that stage of advancement was unbelievable in this day. And then they started making steam fire engines. Amesquite produced the finest steam fire engines in the world. A genius named Nehemiah Bean came to Manchester and made these beautiful machines that were in demand all over the world. Amesquite firefighting apparatus was sold in Peru and Argentina and Japan and China. They were used to fight the San Francisco earthquake fires in 1906 when the gas mains were breaking throughout the town. So it was just, again, a tribute to their ingenuity and their adaptability that allowed the company to keep moving forward until economic circumstances beyond their control ultimately spelled doom for the company.
I do remember seeing that when you said that to me, I do remember my visit to the Mill Yard Museum. You had a film that I think you told us you could date because in the background you saw a car in terms of...
The Amesquite steam fire engines were being filmed in Portland, Maine. They have a firefighting museum up there. And when we were up there, we were looking at some of the footage that was playing. And these are actually Amesquite-made engines in Portland, Maine. And when we were watching the footage, which we've now procured for our museum, we show that the footage, we really couldn't date it until we saw a Model T Ford in the image in the background. So one of my car geniuses said that puts it around 1910. So they were still in great production at that time and high demand. As they weren't made on a production line. These were made to order. So the production quality was really high. No one ever got caught up in that, the Monday or Friday Detroit car that you don't want to buy.
Yeah.
These were always, the finest that was available throughout the world.
It sounds like Manchester was a really hustling, bustling center. And then what happened?
Well, what happened is after the 1922 strike, there was a subsequent strike in 1933. And Amesquite, pardon me, was simply a victim of the economic times. The Depression, number one. The fact that so many more factories were being built in the South, which means the cotton didn't have to take the 1,000-mile journey to Manchester to be turned into cloth. If you've ever driven down to Florida and you hit North Carolina, cannon towels, all the cotton products that were made down there really diluted the economic efficiency of Amesquite. It was cheaper to make it in the South. Wages here were higher. There were unions. There were no unions in the South. All of those competing factors really helped drive Amesquite to the brink. And after the strike of 33, things started up again. But come December 25th, 1935, Christmas Eve, Amesquite declared bankruptcy. And it would have been the death of the city because essentially 17,000 people were put out of work. And of the total of 34,000 people in Manchester, the other half depended upon the Amesquite's jobs for their living, whether you owned a market or a clothing store. If Amesquite's closed, the people are not coming into your store to buy your products or your wares. So it looked like Amesquick was going to try to reorganize. They went down to New York. They were trying to get refinancing. So from December 3rd, from Christmas Eve in 35, fast forward to March of 1936, the single greatest flood ever to strike the Merrimack River. In fact, all of New England came roaring down from the mountains of New Hampshire, the spring freshet. And those mills along the river were filled to the second floor with mud and silt and water, including the heaviest equipment, which was generally kept on the bottom floors. So the notion of Amesquick getting the refinancing to save itself was dashed by that, again, circumstances beyond their control. Now, you would think that, okay, that's the end of the story. What do we do? But this is my hometown, of which I'm incredibly proud. So the people of Manchester realized that a federal bankruptcy court was going to determine the outcome of the Manchester, of the Amesquick Mills. The entire mill yard was going to be auctioned off as one, not individual buildings, the entire mill yard. And the bankruptcy referee said, we think it's worth $5 million. So the people of Manchester got together, including the mayor and the newspaper publisher and the public service director, and approached the bankruptcy referee and said, what's it going to take for us to not allow this to be auctioned off as one entity? And he said, well, you can buy it yourselves. If you come up with $500,000 by Friday and $4.5 million the balance by the following Friday. And in 10 days, the people of Manchester, in 1936, mind you, raised $5 million to purchase all of the assets of Amesquick Manufacturing, the effort being done to prevent another monolithic employer from coming in and dominating the landscape in Manchester as it had for 100 years before. So by doing so, the mission of this new group, which became known as Amesquick Industries, was to diversify, to bring in a lot of different industries. Yes, make fabric, but how about companies that make clothes out of the fabric? Shoe shops were a big, important part of Manchester's economic revival. And so the March of Time newsreel people came to Manchester after this process had occurred, and they did a 7-minute newsreel that showed in theaters all over the country called The City That Wouldn't Die. And as a Manchester kid, I can't tell you how proud I am every time I watch that.
Saved by crowdfunding.
Essentially, if you want to bring it to today's standards, yeah. They never left New Hampshire. They never went outside New Hampshire to raise a dollar to get that $5 million. And that just demonstrates to me how important people thought that institution of the mill yard was to the future of the city. And essentially, we became known as the business success story of 1936 when there weren't many in the country.
So that's the genesis of the names on some of the buildings. Now, I know that where UNH is now, where Andrea's office is, was the sweater shop, right? The Pandora
building. Yes.
Yeah, Pandora building.
I'm actually a mill worker.
Yes, so am I.
Okay.
Yeah, my mom and dad worked in the mills. My grandparents did, and I proudly, that means you get what we call the designation of mill rat. If you were a kid and your parents worked in the mills, you were a mill rat, and well, I wear it proudly.
When I was in first grade, which is a long time ago, we used to come up before school started to buy a sweater set at Pandora, mm-hmm. and it was a big moment.
That was the genius of May Gruber, whose son, Ralph Sidora, lives in Bedford still. Ralph is a great benefactor for us at the Historic Association. He owns the building at 150 Dow Street, in which we store the balance of our collection that we don't have on display. That's May Gruber's son. And May Gruber, again, is the genius who came up here and had as many as 1,000 employees at one time making sweaters that, again, were in demand for anybody who drove through Manchester, stopped at Pandora, whether you were heading up to go skiing, heading to the beach. A stop at Pandora was a mandatory stop to buy sweaters.
And the signage was, you know, memorable and a real landmark, I thought.
We have the sign. It was taken down from the building about 6 years ago, and there was a fund created to save the Pandora sign. And most people remember the very large script Pandora. Right. But the actual sign, including box letters, said Home of Pandora Sweaters. Again, we're trying to repurpose it, but the script is in bad shape because it was curved and is subject to weather for 60 years. But the block letters are surprisingly intact. So we're in negotiations through the Mill Yard Museum to work with a couple of companies that want to preserve parts of the sign. The notion being that they will have a photo of the entire sign next to it and indicate that, yes, these letters were saved from the Pandora sign.
So you're listening to WBNH 105.1, and we're getting a combined history and business lesson from our our very wonderful guest here, John Clayton of the Manchester Historic Association and Mill Yard Museum. And it's just fascinating. You know, we were talking about, and you mentioned how some people have the theory that history is driven by individuals. And so when you tell the history of a place, it's really about people. And I know, because I had the opportunity to go through the museum tour with you, that we had some other notable people that led to some businesses that are well known, including both people in the fragrance area and in fast food. And I wonder if you could let our audience know a little bit about who some of the other prominent people in this area are that really contributed to, in many ways, some of the most successful businesses in American history.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Don. And it's true. When I took over, I mean, I told people that we need to get past 1935. That's when the Amherst declared bankruptcy. And there are legions of people who think history in Manchester stopped at that point, when in fact, I think that's when it got interesting. That's when we demonstrated our character and the way we saved the Mill Yard, you know, from being taken over by another, you know, big one industry town. And so I want to expand beyond that to include people like you mentioned fragrance. The Revson brothers, three brothers from Manchester, were the founders of Revlon Cosmetics. And people have lost sight of the fact because when they left Manchester, and Martin Revson, the youngest brother, was a West High School graduate, as am I, they went into business with a gentleman named Lackman. And they wanted to combine the two names in the way the corporations do. But when you're selling cosmetics and your name is Revlac, it doesn't ring softly on the ears. So they settled on Revlon. And a lot of people around here, again, lost sight of the fact that that company was founded by three brothers from Manchester. Same goes with, you know, the legend of Ray Kroc being the founder of McDonald's, which is a real Kroc, because most people know around this area that two brothers from Manchester, Richard and Morris McDonald, were the founders of McDonald's hamburger restaurants. Ray Kroc was a guy who came in as a franchise salesman. He sold milkshake machines, and he couldn't understand how one restaurant needed five of his machines when the machine made five shakes at a time. And it was that moment for him when Ray Kroc said, I want a part of this. There's a new film coming out in September starring Michael Keaton called The Founder, in which it's ostensibly the story of Ray Kroc. But when I see it, it makes me cringe because I know the McDonald brothers are included in the movie. And the proof is in the slogan, which is that he took someone else's idea and America ate it up. So in September, we put a new display in the museum called our Manchester Wall of Fame. That enabled us to recognize Charles Revson, who is the older of the three brothers who founded Revlon. It gave us a chance to recognize Richard McDonald. At the same time, it gave us a chance to recognize Rene Gagnon, a Marine from Manchester who was one of the six who raised the flag at Iwo Jima. And you and I were speaking earlier, it's back in the news. They're trying to figure out if they misidentified two of the other six men who were there. So Rene Gagnon is recognized. Peyton Place. Peyton Place is a book that everybody owned, but nobody admitted to reading in the 1950s and 60s. That was written by a young lady from Manchester named Grace de Repentini Metallius, who went on, the book went on to become a major bestseller, major motion picture with the biggest stars of the day, Lauren Green, Lana Turner, and then it was a sequel, and it became a primetime soap opera. And again, people forget that Grace Metallius was a Manchester girl. She had moved to Gilmanton, and that's where the story ostensibly was set, but she's a Manchester girl. So we get to recognize these people. Seth Meyers, he's a Bedford kid who's now hosting one of the best comedy shows on television. Adam Sandler is a graduate of Manchester High School Central. Sarah Silverman, who's, you know, a very controversial but brilliant comedian who's attended West High School but graduated from the Derryfield School. So we get to celebrate these people. A young lady from Bedford named Patricia Rossett, who's one of the leading opera singers, soprano opera singers in the world, having performed at the New York Metropolitan Opera, at the Palace Opera, Paris Opera. So we get to recognize these people more contemporary who are having a major impact, not just on our area, but on the nation and the world.
Well, this has been really great. We need to begin winding down. Our time is moving. It's moving along so very, very quickly here.
I have a question.
Yeah,
can
please.
Can I interject? So at what point does history become important to you? So, for example, you know, you're obviously paying attention to what's going on today. At what point does the Historic Association bring that into their grasp?
My contention is history is being made in Manchester every day. The stuff we're seeing now, we were just the subject of a story on Politico.com, a story about Manchester shortly after the primary came out. And we were described as a 19th century mill town that saved itself through preservation and innovation. And to me, that demonstrates that there's no endpoint. The history doesn't stop, I said 1935, nor does it stop in 2015, just because we can't keep up. History's happening every day. And for us to be true to our mission, which is to collect, preserve, and share Manchester history, the next thing Dean Kamen does in the Mill Yard is history making. And right now he's working on a water purification system called Slingshot that will revolutionize healthcare throughout the world. And how do I walk away from that and said, well, it's not dusty enough to be history yet. To me, history is happening every day, and we revel in the fact that we're surrounded by it. I view us as a fish in a tank, and the water is everything that's around us. And being in the mill yard, there's a lot of good stuff happening in the water.
So building off of that, what can we expect over the next year at the museum? Do you have any plans that you can disclose or share with us? Can you give us a sense of, because I do know that you guys, you make an effort to be fresh and refresh your exhibits on an ongoing basis.
Yep.
So where are you going? What does the future hold for the Mill Yard Museum and or the Manchester Historic Association?
Sure. Well, we have a regular summer program of walking tours. You know, the fascination with the Mill Yard never goes away. So on June 4, we'll have a Saturday walking tour from 10 to 2 through the Mill Yard with a guide who'll talk about the history of the place. So that will go on. But for me, one great thing is being able to interact with the other nonprofit partners in and around the community. So we'll be doing an exhibit with the Currier Museum, Manchester in the Urban Landscape, in which they will use photographs of Manchester street scenes down from the 30s on up to today. I just wrote an essay for the Courier magazine, The Town Reborn, about the Mill Yard. So we're going to work with our partners at the Courier, which I'm very excited about. I love that place. Southern New Hampshire University called us. They want to celebrate the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor next year. So they approached me, and I had written about the four Manchester men who died at Pearl Harbor. So that was part of their grant application to the National Endowment for the Humanities. So that's in December of 2017. So it just doesn't stop. So we want to keep aligning and affiliating with these other groups.
Yeah, I know here in Bedford, actually, I believe that you allowed the Friends of the Bedford Cemetery to get access to some photographs to use in a book that they use for fundraising. And so you're really a community resource. And as a Bedford resident, I really appreciate all that you're doing. Can you give us your website and hours of operation?
Yes,
if people want to get over to you, folks, get over there. This is a personal endorsement from Dawn Byrne here on WBNH. Go to the Mill Yard Museum. You will be fascinated. Bring your children, bring your family members. And I guarantee you, you won't go just once because there's so much to see and do. You're not going to be able to absorb it all at one time. You're going to want to go back and back.
Mm-hmm. We're swamped with school kids from Milford this week. They're coming through every single day this week. So our hours of operation are Tuesday to Saturday from 10 to 4. And our phone number is 622-7531. That's 622-7531. Our website is millyardmuseum.org. Oh, no, pardon me, manchesterhistoric.org. But you got to go to our Facebook page. It's Mill Yard Museum. I post photos from our collection every day, and people are fascinated by these images from our past. I did one photo of the old Notre Dame Bridge. Your listeners know what I mean. 31,000 views in a week. Wow. 31,000 views in a week. So Mill Yard Museum is our Facebook page. I guarantee you won't be disappointed if you go there.
Well, John, just before we finish up, we have one tradition here that we like to go through. But I want to take a moment before I turn it over to Andrea to say thank you for your time. It was fascinating. I'm going to nominate you as the most fascinating person to sit next to at a dinner party. It would just be fantastic to go forward and forward. But Andrea, over to you on this.
Well,
if it's an open bar, you definitely want to sit next to me.
If it's a cash bar, I'm sitting next to Don. It's fascinating listening to you tell the stories, and you're so good with all the facts that I'm sitting here with my mouth kind of ajar, just listening and envisioning all the things that you're telling us about. And I really think that you're a great guest. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I just spoke to the Manchester Retired Teachers Association at lunchtime. So all of this stuff is right at my fingertips because they give me no slack whatsoever.
So we do have this little thing that we do. It's to close the radio program. We ask that each guest pick a quote, a business quote for the day. So I will hold it up high.
She's shaking the list of several thousand potential choices here.
Let me make sure I have one. Okay, I've got one. Mark number 15, life is 10% what happens to me and 90% of how I react to it. Charles Swindoll. That's pretty good.
Does anybody know who he is?
I have to admit that I do not.
I don't know how he made the cut then.
Nor do I, but I also know that Woody Allen once said that 90% of life is showing up. So
yeah,
you probably to live by.
Yeah, you probably grabbed that. Well, again, this is Don Byrne and Andrea O'Brien on WBNH 105.1. With our guest, John Clayton. And just terrific, John. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
We really thank you. And I turn it over to, as I do each week, to Andrea to close the show. So over to you, Andrea.
Okay. So, John, you'll appreciate the closing because this is Business IQ Radio. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we really want to drive home is this. You can spend more than you make. but you can only do it for so long.